Today's talk is given by Alex Singleton of the University of Liverpool, who is a reader, as you can see, Geographic Information Science. His talk is entitled Advances in Geographic Data Science, Open Data and Systems. Singleton's research looks at how social and spatial complexities of individual behaviours can be represented and understood within a framework of quantitative social science and computer modelling. His research has extended the geographic tradition of area classification, developing a broad critique of the ways in which geodemographic methods can be refined through modern scientific approaches to data mining, geographic information science, and quantitative human geography. As well as a variety of published papers on the future of geodemographic research, amongst other things, several blog entries also make very interesting reading, in particular his recent assertion that geographers should relearn their long-lost programming skills in order to best make use of the wealth of open and big data sets now available. Given the ubiquitous nature of GIS point and click, which we all suffer from and suffer with, we are therefore most fortunate to welcome Alex here to show us just what we can achieve with such skills, and hopefully that we can acquire these skills fairly quickly and easily, and be able to analyse these volumes of GI data. Alex.
Thank you for the nice introduction. Essentially, the title of my talk, Advanced Geographic Data Science, Open Data and Systems, there was two components to that. The data component, and I'm going to phrase that in terms of open data. I've inserted the word big in there as well, which I use skeptically. And then in terms of the systems aspect of geographic data science, refer to two case studies which have emerged from some of my research. I think the initial content we had was talking about the Census Atlas project I did, so I put that in there as one of my examples. And then a final bit is just my musings on where I think things are going in terms of the advances. So, geographic data science is an emerging term that's being used to refer to a series of different things, from geographic information science to spatial analysis through geocomputation on the more applied side through to geographic visualisation. And certainly in the way in which my group at the University of Liverpool implement geographic data science, we're interested really in problems that have got global social and economic importance. So the problems that we look at typically aren't necessarily theoretical, but they do have some applied relevance. Open data, and this is a definition which I've cribbed off the ODI's website, the Open Data Institute's website rather. And basically, open data is information that's available for anyone to use for any purpose, and there's no cost that's attributed to that. So they're essentially, you can use them for anything. You can use them for commercial purposes. You could make a profit on them, and you wouldn't have to pay anyone a license fee. It's not just in the UK that these types of data are increasingly prevalent. This is an example from the US, the data.gov website, and that's the US's repository for open data. And you can search for different data sets on there and download them. They're not all spatial data sets, but quite a lot of them are. In the UK context, we've got data.gov.uk, and again, you can search for different types of data sets. Typically, these repositories will link off to third-party websites, and you can download the data directly from there. But they mainly act as a catalogue of metadata for these different data that are available. One of the really exciting things about open data in the UK is this idea of linked data. And I think it's becoming more prevalent in different countries as well, but certainly in the UK we are pushing this. And if you're not familiar with linked data, what linked data is essentially if you, within a secure environment, can get access to the individual level records of a series of different, let's say, administrative data, using various heuristics, you can merge these things together. So you can then, for example, in this example, you can track pupils through school, different key stages, and then perhaps on to university. And what then you can do is you can sanitise that data, that might be in terms of spatial aggregation, and then the wider public can use those linked data. So this example actually does exist. You can actually track pupils from primary school into higher education. it was available about 4 or 5 years ago for a brief window of about 4 months, of which I was very fortunate to get a data extract. And then they decided they couldn't do that anymore because it was illegal to give out other people's data. And they withdrew that facility. But fortunately, I got a paper out to the EPA on that. So there is actually a paper using big data. I think there was another one around that time on this same data set. Really fortunately, about a week ago, they've actually changed their mind. It isn't illegal. So you can get these data. So if you're interested, it's probably going to get it now before they change their mind back. That's a STAT Open shortcut, so some of you may know who STAT Open Short is. And you'll see at the bottom right, I've copyrighted it to STAT Open Short, which I think he probably owns these STAT Open shortcuts. I thought about that a little bit more. STAT Open Short is quite a progressive academic, so he's probably far more likely to put Creative Commons license on his cards. But that sort of leads on to the next point, that open data is not open data unless you've actually attributed a license to it. So you can put data in the public domain, but if you've not told anyone how they can use it, it isn't really open data. And if you go to the ODI website, there's lots of sort of advice and guidance about how you can actually unpick that. And there's various licenses you just copy and paste. And it's just a matter of being explicit in how your data can be reused. And there's the two types most prevalent are a sort of attribution license, where you just say who it belongs to, or share alike, where if you do something with it, you can basically put that out with the same license that you received the data. However, there's another big but. This is a big but. And this is one, I think, for me personally, drives me bananas when we start talking about open data. It may be it may be less prevalent now, but certainly a few years ago, any data that was sort of in the public domain was classed as sort of open data. People were getting all these things mixed up. And these are the typical types of data which often are sort of confused with open data. They really aren't. These are free data. So you can use the various application programming interfaces of Facebook, and Google, and Twitter, Foursquare, perhaps more in the US. And you can say lots of interesting things. But that isn't open data. All the information which is on those networks is owned by those companies who actually run them. I mean, if you want to use that data in a commercial context, that could actually be sort of quite difficult. Certainly, most of the time, it's locked down. So free data is not open data. And I suppose this is probably the thorniest of the issues. You'll know who that is if you're a Star Trek fan, or why it's big data, but that is data out of Star Trek Next Generation. He's larger than that. This image, incidentally, I wouldn't claim to be the artistic genius, but it was circulating on the web a couple of weeks ago, and I thought it was quite amusing. So, big data, I'd say I'm fairly sceptical of what this actually is. I think there's a very large disjunction between the reality of what these information are and the sort of fantasy which is propagated from companies trying to sell services. And I suppose the simplest way, I've got sort of two examples of reasons why I think some of this data is perhaps not all it's sort of cracked up to be. I think if you're to believe the marketing hype behind big data, you know, you're sort of solve some of these sort of global problems. But I've probably got a slightly different view on it, I think, than sort of the marketeer's view. And I suppose this would be my first example of why it's problematic. And this is two stories that are fairly recent. One is at the city that I live in, which is in Liverpool Echo, newspaper cutting, how the council's having to borrow £200 million to fix all the holes in the road. Liverpool, we've never been there. It does have the worst roads of any city I've ever lived in. It's appalling. And then at the other end of the spectrum, a smaller photograph, what you can maybe be able to make out that it's quite small, there's a small circle in the centre of that parking bay, and this is in Westminster. And what Westminster are doing is sort of this tradition of smart cities are installing parking bay sensors. So, you know, one part of the UK, we've got a city borrowing money hand over fist to try and repair holes, basic infrastructure. But in another part of the sort of global city, we've got these sort of interesting parking sensors. So in terms of how these things, how big the sort of the advantages of big data and smart cities sort of felt geographically. There's going to be large differences just depending on sort of how sort of affluent your city are. One of the other types of data, in addition to these sort of sensor type networks which are getting installed in various places, another type of big data is social media data. And again, this has to be mediated with quite a number of caveats. So there's a statistic that I think in terms of the geocoding, there's 100 tweets on that slide. Between 1 and 2% of the tweets are geocoded. So the rest of the tweets, I mean, they may have no relevance to spatial location at all, but that said, there's no spatial referencing on those at all. So you've got a very tiny proportion of the total tweets which actually have any location attributes. And in addition to that, there's absolutely nothing about the quality of those locations. So, hypothetically, I'm pretty sure that if I tweeted now, I would still be located in Liverpool, because the location references on my Twitter account wouldn't have updated. There's lots of different ways in which they're set, and it's not clear. It's not clear to the sort of the API user how they've necessarily been set, and the degrees to which there may be less of accuracy and precision problems in that. So that's one issue. The spatial referencing can be dubious, and it's also not particularly prevalent. And there's a slightly more concerning issue, which I think is highlighted quite well by this application. This is one that probably should have perhaps in Liverpool, although it's less where is your street bumpy, more where is your street smooth. But what this is an iPhone application which sits in your car. You start it up and sit in your car. And when you go over a pothole, it records your car going down, and it sends that information up to the mayor's office, who then presumably uses that to apportion road repairs. Apparently in Boston, they have a similar sort of problem with sort of their roads falling apart as the pavilions. Now, it's only available on iPhones, which, I mean, you know how expensive iPhones are. And this, I think, this is actually Edinburgh, incidentally. This is a map by someone called Eric Fisher. It took 280 million tweets. He looked at the type of phones that these mobile tweets were being sent from. And you know, principally, if you're living in Apple Park City, you're more likely to be using iPhones than an Android phone, for example. So if you've got an application that only runs on an iPhone, you know, you're using that to assign ways you go and fix people's roads, and it's quite likely that people who live in affluent areas' roads are going to get fixed more quickly than people who live in poor areas. So we've really got to unpick some of these sort of problems, which are sort of the sort of unhelpful in the impacts of having these new technologies, these new big data. I suppose one of the other problems I have is that there's all these companies who are quite keen on the idea of big data as something that exists, it's real, there's a flood of it, and they have all these various bits of software and services that they can sell on the back of it. So I think there has to be caution with sort of the messages which are sort of associated with their sales pitches with regards to the services that they're trying to sell, because obviously they want to make a profit. Now, I think probably I would take a more sort of reserved view of what big data is. And this is, you may not know Mike Batty, he's a professor at University College London, I used to work with. And over beers, he often sort of deliver his pearls of wisdom. And Mike's definition of big data is probably the one that I would sort of resonate with, mostly, particularly in the context of social sciences, that it's anything that won't fit on a spreadsheet. And I'm quite happy with that. One of the other points I wanted to make when I actually started thinking about this is I also don't think any of this is new at all. And really what big data is just a disjunction between the volume of data and the ability to process it. And that isn't a new phenomenon. That's something, you know, since the start of doing sort of computerized analysis has been an issue. You've never been able to process as much data perhaps as you wanted. So The example here, say I mentioned in my introduction, I'm a geodemographics nerd. The very first geodemographic classification, which are categorical measures of the types of people and residential structures within small area of geography. The very first one of those classifications was actually built for Liverpool in the 1970s by someone called Richard Weber. And this is the classification here from his 1970 publication. And in that, if you actually read through the methodology, the critical thing was this was one of the first sort of digitised censuses. One of the critical problems they had, and they had to solve in order to build this classification. And bear in mind, this is just for a city. This was their big data problem. Was how you actually go about doing it. They didn't have a computer fast enough to be able to cluster multiple areas via multiple attributes. So what they did was they had to collapse the attributes. So rather than having, say, 100 attributes, they perhaps could only have the computer could only manage, say, 3. So they produced principal components for, instead of attributes, which looked at capturing sort of the majority of the variance in the variables that they had. They also wanted to reduce the number of areas that they were actually clustering. So although they had a small zone of geography, they actually did some pre-clustering to actually group some of those smaller areas into larger areas. And that's quite similar to what we do now. So if we look at the sort of output area to the lower super-output area of geography, they were creating in a similar way. So what that ends up doing is basically reducing the dimensions of your data set, which actually enable you to do the clustering on them and form these geodemographic groups. That was big data in the 1970s, and this was a methodological solution for handling big data. And even in the 70s, you know, this isn't new in area classification. Sheffield Williams, which was the precursor to this, precursor to geodemographics, rather, which was social area analysis. Shefkin Williams produced it's a typological model of the city using methodology, again, constrained by the number of attributes they could handle in their sort of analytical technique. They later had to go back and they sort of post-rationalise that in this study of Shefkin. But again, it was just a big data problem, which they found a sort of methodological solution to sort of handle. So I think, in terms of general trends in data and open data more generally, this is sort of the past decade. The census is obviously every 10 years. They take a little while to come out. So 01, I think, came out about 03. And some of our census data, perhaps a little bit later than in England, Wales and Scotland, has been coming out over the past sort of year or so. And that really, for sort of like the past sort of 30, 40 years, has been the main data sets that social scientists have used. And really, in the time that I've been involved in academia, I started my PhD in 2003, it's changed completely. And I got very interested in, as a PhD student, administrative data. I did a linked award with University College Admission Service. So actually, in 2003, when I started my PhD, I actually thought the census was really boring. I never used it. I didn't find it interesting at all. Instead, I went straight into using administrative data. And at the time, in 2003, administrative data was quite difficult to get hold of. It was sort of, you had to know the right people. You're sort of friendly to them, and they send you the sort of data on a CD, and get lost in the mail, being sort of the Daily Mail, you've lost all these children's personal records and things like that. But that's obviously over time, it's all been tightened up. Administrative data has sort of transformed into open data. The licenses have been sharpened. The procedures for accessing data have been sharpened and also made more transparent and open. So it's not about who you know. But if you want to go and get education data now, you can basically fill a form in online, send it off, and there's an approval procedure. More recently, social media data, I say, has become available. And what these different data sets have done is they're basically sharpening up the sort of the spatial resolution from sort of quite large aggregate data down to individual level information about people and the places in which they live. It's also turning the data from sort of more aggregate temporal resolution, the sort of decades between each census, down to whether, in the context of social media data, if you to ignore some of those issues I was talking about, down to sort of seconds. You know, you can go and find out how many tweets have been within the vicinity of this talk just by running a short script on a website. But I think, prospectively, one of the things which is very, very interesting, which I think there's going to be a lot more noise about over the next sort of 12 months, is business data, and particularly in the area of retail, and how those data sets can actually be opened up to the general public. And there's various initiatives which are sort of ongoing with the Economic and Social Research Council to try and stimulate some of that to happen. So I think that's quite an interesting area. So in terms of data, before I get onto some of the applications, I suppose these are what I think to be the grand challenges with regards to using some of these new data sets. The first one sort of relates to what I was talking about, Twitter. You know, what are these data representative? Are they geographically representative? Are they socially representative? In terms of the data which is generated, sensors, satellites, Twitter, social media, what should be captured and what shouldn't, and how do we capture it, what formats, what are the ethical considerations of using some of these data? So, you know, the fact that if I use Twitter data to stitch together a person's journey to work, for example, you know, I'm invading their privacy. You know, they've agreed to disseminate that data. I don't know, there's ethical considerations. But I think, critically, is how we use the data imaginatively. So, how can we actually use the data, perhaps for more creative uses to solve some of these important problems, which weren't necessarily envisaged when the data themselves were created. So, you know, a classic example might be looking at sort of flu prevalence from search, Google search results, for example. Okay, so the first example I want to give. I suppose in terms of my use of open data, this really moves on to the systems side of the talk. I suppose it's also a sales pitch for my favourite system, which is the R programming language. Is a project which I completed fairly recently on CO2 emissions in the context of school commuting. And what this concerned was a very large data set from the Department for Education, around 7.5 million school trips across England. And in that data, we knew where the pupils lived, we knew which school they went to, so we had an origin and they had a destination. Between 2007 and 2012, they also recorded what the travel mode was for the pupils. So, whether you went by car, typically by car, by bike, and so on. So a very, very rich data set. The other data I had for this project was through a colleague of mine. I suppose it's going back to the Wild West of who you know. This isn't open data, but it was data that I was given from the Department for Transport. And what they generated for me was lower superapt area level CO2 emissions estimates for cars which are registered to households within those areas, which was quite interesting. And then finally, the actual application itself is built purely on open source software, making it sort of entirely leverageable. So the way in which CO2 emissions are typically estimated in the context of commuting are illustrated by this diagram. The red dotted line is a straight line distance between a pupil's home, a real pupil's home, and a school. And what you would do in the calculation to estimate, in sort of non-geographical calculation to estimate the CO2 emissions, is you basically, you multiply that distance by the emissions per kilometre on average of a car. And you do that for all of the pupils that you're estimating emissions for, and that's your basically your total emissions score. There's a lot of problems with that because we don't go to school in a straight line. We might not necessarily go by car. If we live in different parts of the country, we're likely to have different types of cars, which can have different sort of characteristics in terms of pollution. And that's they're the basic attributes that I was trying to resolve. But I mean, the model could be extended for lots of different things. You could actually simulate the impact of inclines on emissions in the car. So you could actually weight trips. You could weight them by the number of probable stops, for example. Because every time you slow your car down, start it up, you're using sort of emitting more CO2 and stuff. So the model which I created is based on that equation there. It's fairly straightforward. It's just the distance. In terms of a road distance, we've got an algorithm which predicts the probable routes between the pupil's home and the pupil's school. We take into account a local CO2 emission which is linked to a particular type of transport. So in this context, we'd be looking at perhaps a car or going along that blue route. But in the context of rail travel, for example, or tube, we'd actually look at the tube distance or the probable route they took on the tube or light rail. The CO2 emissions which go into the model, this map that you can see is actually the low sea ground area average CO2 per kilometre. So the darker blue is more polluting cars within those areas. So you can see around sort of London, it's very dark, so people live sort of in the commuter belt of London typically have larger, more polluting cars. You can see some other spots as well, sort of south of Manchester in Cheshire, again in the quite affluent area, people sort of driving large four-wheel drives and such. More generally, you get patches of more polluting cars in rural areas, which is perhaps not, it's fairly understandable given that the sort of road conditions might be worse than they would be in cities. You'd also say you'd see quite very good eyesight, but if you look in sort of southwest of London, you can see there's a sort of slightly darker patch there, and that's the rural borough of Richmond, which is very affluent and full of people who drive four-wheel drive cars with the treacherous terrain in terms of South London's roads. And then the other data in terms of CO2 emissions attributed to particular transport types are in this table here. So there's nationally each year there's a government report which actually details the different estimates they're going to use in their various sort of estimation models, and these are taken from that. The cycling and the walking actually do emit CO2 when you're doing those activities. So they were taken from some research papers. There's not a huge amount of evidence. There's not a huge amount of research on the cycling and walking CO2 emissions. But the other ones, there's quite a number of reports which actually re-look at these CO2 emissions for these different transport types. Some transport types like light rail, for example. In this report, they actually disaggregate by the different rail networks. So in my model, I can count for them. So if I know what the probable rail network is that you've taken, sorry, the probable light rail network that you've taken, I can apply a slightly different CO2 emission. So in terms of software infrastructure for this, the OpenStreetMap data are used as the road topology, and also the light rail and the tube topology. The roads are pushed into a software library called Routino, which is an open source routing library. It takes the OpenStreetMap data, and you can supply an origin and destination, and you get a probable route. And all the algorithms that it uses are in the public domain. The light rail data and the tube data, they were cleaned up in QGIS principally to ensure that there were just single lines, because OpenStreetMap is quite detailed, so if you've got sort of an eastbound and a westbound line, you might have two railway networks, but in terms of a routing application, you only want a single line. So it was ensuring there was only a single line for all the sort of networks, for each of the light rail networks and also the London Tube. It was ensuring that all the nodes where trains could actually change direction, that there were nodes at those particular points where the lines crossed, and also that there were nodes for every single potential station, because part of the algorithm to do the routing involves getting pupils linked to their nearest station. That was actually about a month's work. It was really boring, but it's been done, so I can, if anyone wants, I can actually give you the shape files for those. Those don't work directly in Routino, so the non-road-based routing was done in a PostgreSQL database. So all of that data was dumped into PostgreSQL database. Railway data, so not light rail and tube, that came from an ordnance survey reading 2, because it's actually in pretty good condition. It didn't really need any cleaning because it was already clean. And again, that went to PostgreSQL as well. There's an extension for PostgreSQL called PostGIS, and there's an extension for PostGIS, I think, would be the sort of called PG Routing. And that's the thing that actually does the routing on these spatial data sets. In addition to that, the sort of data I mentioned in the previous slide went in there, so the schools data, the Department for Transport data went in there as well. So this is essentially how the actual algorithm works in terms of calculating CO2 emission for each route. Using R, so R is a statistical programming language, can do lots of things in itself, or you can call sort of third-party libraries like Routino, or query external data repositories, so in this context, my database. Because this is a spatially enabled database with this PG routing extension, the actual routing calculations are done in the database, and all R's doing is calling the database to do the query and bring the results from the query back into R. In theory, you could supplement R with Python or any other scripting language. So the first thing it does is it gets a pupil's origin, destination, and mode. It then decides whether it's light rail or tube or rail, and it's, if it is, it routes that through PG routing, it gets a distance, returns that back to R. If it's road, it sends the query off to Routino, and it queries the sort of the origin destination trip in Routino, and again returns that distance back into R. Then what it does is it decides whether it was a car-based journey or not. If it was, it does a pointing polygon on the student's home, and it takes those CO2 estimates I showed you before, and then it basically uses that in the calculation against the distance that it's got for that particular route. If it wasn't, it uses those other national averages or the network averages. If, for example, it was the light rail in Blackpool versus light rail in Sheffield. I've just got a couple of. I'm not going to dwell too much on the results of this. It's more about the software, but I think it's quite interesting. This is a chart where the x-axis is the distance from the pupil's home, and the squiggly coloured lines that you see are the percentage of pupils adopting certain types of travel. So the NOM, which is the blue line, is non-mechanised transport, so that's basically cycling and walking, and you can see that over distance that tails off, as you might expect. Over 5.5 kilometres, basically nobody's going to school by those methods. And you can see that to replace that, some of the other methods, so the green line is car transport, rises, and you've got bus rising again, and train as well is a slightly steadier curve. And then you can see sort of on the far right-hand side, it sort of starts to peak up, because over those distances, it's probably not... you could drive it, but it would probably take a ridiculous amount of time. There's sort of rare cases as well, I'd probably say. But it's probably the only method that you could take. And you can actually do interesting things. If you can calculate these models for these large volumes of data at the individual level, you can carve this up however you like. So you can look at the differences between school years, you can look at the differences between different types of school selection policies. There's a whole raft of different things that you can actually look at. And this was the results from the model. This was just looking at local authority differences. So if you took sort of a non-geographical model, so the way which I described with the straight lines and sort of national averages, and you took the geographically weighted approach, which is the one I've just described, you can see that for certain local authorities, there are sort of under or over estimations relative to the sort of the basic model. So if you're actually looking at these problems sort of below a sort of national level, implementing a geographical model which actually takes account of things like local transport preferences and street topology and that kind of thing is quite important. Okay, so that was sort of my first sort of big data example. This is a slightly different project. I mean, a slightly less academic project, I suppose. But it was something that I'd sort of been thinking about for a very, very long time. When the last census came out, I always remember thinking, this was when I just started my PhD, it'd be really nice if you could automate the creation of all these maps. And at that time, I was an ArcGIS user. I'd never done any programming, so I wasn't really up to it in order to do that. But this time around, when the census data came out, I knew I could do this. I thought it would be quite interesting just to try and map everything. I wasn't sure how long it would take. It had to be automated, which has its own challenges. But I think the original took about 2 days to run. So it takes 2 days to map it. I did that on the 5th of February last year, the 2011 Census Atlas. It was a couple of days after the data got released. Since then, I've done Japan, which is a tip I would say is if you ever get invited somewhere to go and do some talks, if you show them something interesting, it's quite likely they're going to want something very similar for their own context, as in payment of them there sort of flying you over to whatever country it is they're flying you over to. So I was over there, felt bad, ended up doing a census atlas for Japan, which actually turned out quite complicated because the data is a lot more voluminous than the data we have. And incidentally, I think their census are every 5 years as well, so I may get a knock on the door next year or something. But nonetheless, the England and Wales census atlas got picked up by The Guardian, which was very helpful. And it was one of those things which was just serendipity that a co-editor on a journal that I'm an editor of happened to be sat next to Simon Rogers, who was their sort of data champion at The Guardian. He works for Twitter now. He happened to go, he was having a meeting with him, and I tweeted that I'd done this, and then he showed it to Simon, and Simon got excited, and then the next minute it was on The Guardian website, and then it all got very busy. But since then, there was a series of things wrong with that initial atlas, which I'll come on to in a minute. Which I was never quite happy with. So I'm about to put the sort of second version of that out. Well, it's ready to go, I just need to have some time to check it. Hopefully we'll pick it up again, because what I did end up getting on the back of this Guardian stuff was quite a lot of contact from local authorities. Because obviously this was just when the census data had come out. And they were sort of saying how it would save them a lot of time, because they were going to have someone sat in a room for X number of years, mapping everything. And basically they don't have to, because they can just go to page 4 and they've got the map they want. Most local authority users seem to just want current depth maps, and if you can do that for free, then you know, all the better. So the process for building these atlases is that our queries, notice have got bulk downloads of all the census data at arbitrary level. So our sends a query to notice, it pulls down all the zip files, it unzips them all, imports all the data as CSVs. So it's got all the areas and all the attributes. It's got a list of all the local authorities as one. And then the second thing it does is it pulls down a set of arbitrary boundaries from the ONS website and a set of broad boundaries from the ONS website. And again, they're more open data. And then the process of generating the maps is there's sort of two nested loops. The first loop runs through the local authorities in order. And with each of those local authority loops, there's a loop which gets all the variables for that local authority and produces a map. And the way it produces a map is it takes that particular variable that it's looking at. The breaks are calculated using sort of JECs, which is just one of many different breaks algorithms you do. There's some checks and things which happen as well, so if you happen to, for a local authority, have a variable and there was like zeros for everything, there's obviously no point mapping that because it's pointless, so it would skip that particular map. So you don't necessarily get all the maps for all local authorities, but you do get all the maps where it's sensible to map that variable. The maps are generated separately from the bespoke legend for the map, and then they use the R then calls another external library called PDF crop, which is quite a neat thing, which basically crops the PDF, which is what the map's created as, to the bounding extent of the PDF, so there's no white space around, which is quite useful when you're trying to lay the map out on a sort of on a document. The documents themselves, in terms of the atlases, are created using LaTeX. So what R does after it's generated all the maps for a particular local authority is it generates a sort of header block of LaTeX code that sets up what the document looks like, whether it's going to have a table of contents, and then it generates a series of blocks of LaTeX which actually put the images within the LaTeX documents. That's in terms of laying out the actual map itself, the legend, and then also the caption for that particular image as well. And it does that for all of them. It uses the terminal again to actually render the LaTeX into a PDF document, then calls another external library called PDFTK, which takes that PDF that you've created with all the maps in and the cover, puts it together, and then it actually finds an atlas. And that essentially is the process for creating. It runs over, I've just done version 2, I think it took just under 2 days to do all of that. So, I mean, my computer's quite good, but I mean, it's not, you know, feasible for most people's computers to run it over sort of less than a week. Version 2 differs from version 1. I essentially corrected the mistakes. I did the previous one in about 2 days, I think, so I was really keen to get it out. And then I noticed I'd done things like I hadn't put what the legends were, so people go, well, what's 4.1? And then I'm like, it's percentages, because they're all percentage. But then I realised, actually, no, they're not, because some of them are density and other ratios. And then I was like, oh, I better put a label on it. So I fixed that. The first ones didn't have scale bars because I hadn't worked out at that particular point how to do that in R, but I have now. So you have a scale bar on. There's slight challenges with doing things like scale bars because you've got to give an XY location of where you're going to place it, but you don't know what the shape of the local authorities are. So you have to add in sort of heuristics which look at the sort of shape, the shape of the local authority. With doing it in LaTeX, whereas the first version I didn't, I actually just read it out. The static PDFs which I stitched together. The good thing about doing it later is you can add a list of figures at the start of the document, which means you can actually, if you want a map of a particular ethnic group, you can just cycle down the list, click on it, and the hyperlink to the atlas, to the actual images and the actual maps themselves. If you click on the map again, it's bringing you back to the list of figures again, so it's a lot more interactive. Previously, I excluded Welsh only variables because it was problematic in the way they've written the code. And also I labelled everything in the previous version, and I now suppress labels for places where it makes no sense. So the place name labels come from the ward data. For places like Cornwall, which are very large, ward labels are just far too cluttered. I mean, there's other things you could do, but in the context of this new version, I've just suppressed them. And what you end up getting out of that is something that looks a little bit like that. So that's just two of the maps for Liverpool and Manchester looking at where students live. See what the student settings. But you've got these maps for every local authority in the country now. I hope people find this second version a bit more useful. But if you do a bit of searching on local authorities, a lot of local authorities have picked these up and have sort of shared them on their own websites and things. So I think it's probably quite a useful exercise. One of the things which I've done in this new version, which again I suppose is another sort of software advance, and it's been a bit of a learning curve for me, has been the use of version control. So this cat octopus thing is the logo for GitHub, which is one of the, sort of the large version control software which you can actually use. There's another one called Bitbucket. The difference between GitHub and Bitbucket is everything you've got into GitHub is entirely in the public domain, which is fine if that's what you want to do. On Bitbucket, if you're an academic, you can actually make these repositories private. So I started using these version controls for collaborative writing. So we can share, we write in LaTeX typically or Markdown, which is sort of a slight simpler version of LaTeX. We can share that code on the version control, and with a paper it's almost like you've got track changes But obviously, you probably don't want sort of your half-finished versions of papers in the public domain. So using Bitbucket in that context is quite this funny RAND logo is a bit of software called SourceTree, which makes uploading, downloading, committing to your repository quite simple. I think that's available on Windows and OS X. But it's also a lot more flexible, I think, than I've given it credit for, in that you can actually run things like entire websites on GitHub for free. So my blog runs entirely on GitHub. It uses some extension software called Jekyll. That's my blog, so if you want to go and get the source code for my blog, you can get it there. And that's what it looks like. And it's this framework that I've also done the second version of this census atlas in. So all the source code, and I'll do a blog post on this fairly shortly, actually, so next week anyway. All the source code for actually generating those atlases is available on my GitHub page. And because you said you can use GitHub to actually host websites, I've just done a quick website as well, so you can actually download all the PDFs and stuff there as well. And one of the nice things about putting things in the public domain in terms of your code and sharing code is that other people can use it. So this was James Reed and Dina. James, I've met James. No? Okay, his colleagues are. So, James is very, very helpfully used my first version of the code after that was disseminated to do a similar project for Northern Ireland. So he produced all the Northern Ireland maps, which was PDFs. So he took, like, in fact, he actually did a better job than me because you see he's labelled things like the legend. He hasn't put scale bars in, so that was quite tricky to sort out. But, you know, you can basically, the code's there, you can go and use it. You know, someone could go and do it with a census data, Scotland census data if they wanted to. I'd probably like to do it myself, but I don't have time. It's taken me a year to get around to do the second version of this. I had these great intentions when I started this project. Oh, yeah, I'll map everything, all the variables, the univariate variables, the lot. But in the end, it's just not worked out. I got distracted by Japan, and it's a year revisiting the first one, which I've done wrong. So perhaps someone else can do a better job than me. Rough savings of doing this. This is a bit tongue-in-cheek, really, but in that Guardian article, I had to guess how many maps I've created. I had no idea. So this time I counted, and there was 134,567 maps were created. So if you take 5 minutes a map, 467 days without a break, which is pretty extreme, even if you're a map geek. So if you do a 35-hour working week, 6 weeks holiday a year, it takes about 6.9 years. I found an average salary there, 20,030 quid for a GIS technician, £138,000. So you can save quite a lot of money by scripting stuff. Last bit of the talk, speculations. I suppose this first slide is sort of speculation to sort of reiterate what I said previously. I don't think big data is new. I just think big data is a disjunction between what data you can get, how you can store it, how you can process it. I think what will happen is different methodologies will emerge for sort of managing some of those issues associated with having a mismatch between data and how you actually do stuff with it. But I do think it is a great opportunity, as all data is, to do interesting things and to solve problems, a sort of global concern. One of the things I do find really annoying, and this goes back to my slide with all of those logos on, I don't think we should talk about big data in terms of technological platforms. I think we should start with problems to solve, and then use the data in ways which is intelligent. We shouldn't just chuck out sort of good social science practice because large corporations are telling us that they've got sort of the solutions to all our problems. I don't think it works like that. I think the market's going to change quite drastically. I think open source GIS is exploding at the moment. Anyone who's used Quantum GIS or QGIS will know it's a really solid platform and it can do a lot of things that other sort of desktop-based GIS can't, or in a simpler way. I don't use it, I use R, but that's personal preference. I think the implications for that for commercial GIS companies is it's going to probably refocus their efforts on things that the open source community don't do as well, so cloud platforms. So it may be that there'll be lesser investment in desktop GIS, more investment in online sort of cloud-based GIS, selling software as services. One of the things I thought was quite interesting, this is actually, I picked this up off Twitter the other day, it's actually an old Freedom of Information request. There's been a few of these over the years. This one was to Durham in 2012. And it just goes to show how expensive commercial licenses for GIS software are. And this is no gripe at Esri in particular, but this particular local authority spent £86,360 per annum on a renewal license, and that would have been on top of whatever they purchased the software for originally. So it's quite a large investment, and that wouldn't be unusual. And you sort of think, you know, it doesn't take a sort of huge leap of imagination to say, what if they swap to sort of open source GIS? You might think that's not very likely, but this was in the papers this week. So the government want to ditch Microsoft Office and go with open source solutions because that might be the, I mean, that could happen in the GIS arena as well. So I think the market's going to change quite drastically. I think in terms of academic work, I think reproducibility is going to be increasingly important facet of what we do. So I'm really keen on reproducibility. The way I work now is that, I won't say all of my papers because it's not true, but the vast majority of my papers now, I write in either Markdown or SWEAVE, and what they are, SWEAVE is a sort of an adapted version of LaTeX, which you actually can embed chunks of R code within the LaTeX document itself. So when you render that document into a PDF, the analysis that you've actually specified within those chunks of code actually get turned into whatever you said the outputs were. So that could be a block of code, it could be a table, it could be a graph, a map, or whatever. So it's all completely self-contained. So if I was a reviewer and I was a bit unsure of how someone has specified their statistical model, I could actually look at the raw code, if you like, for their paper that they've written, and actually say, oh, look, you know, parameter X is wrong, you should have thought about this. And it's a whole new level of clarity about how we actually do science. And in the social sciences, this is really rare. And actually, I don't think there is a single journal in the social sciences which actually would accept this as a format. But in other fields, this is becoming the norm, that you actually have to submit your data and your code with your journal articles in order for them to be sort of deemed fully peer-reviewed. And if you think about some of the issues where people haven't been totally transparent or have made mistakes in their analysis, we're going back to sort of issues with these sort of UEA, with the climate data, the case in the US with a misspecification in an Excel workbook, which basically implied that right-wing policies to sort of cut deficits were a good thing. Actually, we're wrong because they missed out a couple of countries from this particular calculation. These types of problems wouldn't happen if all the data was in the public domain and all the procedures used for analysis were in the public domain and open to scrutiny. I think that's really what we should be aiming for. So I think whether or not this will happen, I don't know. I think reproducibility is a really good thing. If you're just doing a little tiny bit of R coding and you want to just put it out there nice and simply, there's a great bit of software called R Studio, which basically is like an interface to R, makes it a little bit easier to use. One of the great things about that is it hooks up to something called R Markdown, RMD, which again, like this SWEAVE file, but with a much simpler syntax of Markdown, you can embed little blocks of R programming code in between text. You click the button and it renders it into a nice PDF, HTML document. And you can upload it for free onto, you can see that small icon over there on the bottom right called R Pubs. And all it is just a repository for these little documents. It's online, you give people the URL. And actually, before I started using GitHub, that's how I used to do all of my R programming. I prefer GitHub now, so because I actually use it in my sort of workflow when I'm writing. I suppose the final sort of point of speculation is really on education, and this goes to a piece I wrote for Geographical Magazine just before Christmas, which is in the current issue, which is out at the moment. And this is, I mean, I think it's probably me, you know, starting as a lecturer sort of three and a bit years ago, sort of reflecting on the things I didn't like at the start and what I've done since to change. So for my GIS class, we don't use ArcGIS anymore. We just do everything in R. And I think in part that's it's a response to what I've seen happen in the market, in that students now, when they leave, being able to use a piece of GIS software, it doesn't really matter that much. It's not that difficult to do. If they can do some scripting and programming, they've got a wealth of sort of job opportunities available to them. And it's sort of a response to that, I guess, that I really think we should be trying to teach students how to code. If you look at what's happened in sort of school curriculum, so when I was sort of doing GCSEs and A-levels, doing some IT, learning how PowerPoint worked, those kind of things, which was, I mean, to be honest, even when I was at school, it was pretty much borderline useless, but they've sort of realised that now. And there's actually more computer science in those kind of curriculums now, so the actual students are coding. There's interesting initiatives at sort of an earlier stage, things called Code Club, if you Google that, which are people who volunteer their time to teach programming in sort of basic ways to some primary school students. So the students who are coming up at the moment are going to be more aware of doing things. They're not necessarily going to be scared of the terminal, perhaps, as some of the students that we have at the moment. So I think if we can embed that into our curriculums in some way, even at an undergraduate level, I think that will be quite beneficial. So really that article, it's actually copy and pasted on my blog, it's all about that. And it generated quite a lot of interest. There's probably, I've had more comments on that, I think, than anything I've done previously. But it seemed to sort of spark something in people's minds. Broadly, people are in agreement. I think it's probably a good idea. I mean, it may just be the sort of characteristics that people who read my blog. So, with that, in a nutshell, was all I had to say today. But if you've got any questions, more than happy to answer them.
Thank you. A gradual transition away from ArcGIS as well will give me time to migrate, guys. Anyone else?
Right. Could you comment on the size of the team that you implement in replacing ArcGIS moving to the open source environment if you're currently using ArcGIS in a sort of mainstream way?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be quite interested. there's certainly in the US, I've seen in sort of local authority or public sector use, more sophisticated uses of GIS as an infrastructure for managing data within organisations. Whereas the uses I've tended to see in the UK, and that was universally the case, are more basic, so it might just be to make a map. Now, if my uses were of GIS were just to make a map, I wouldn't spend a lot of money on doing that. And in fact, I might not even use an open source bit of software, because there's probably four or five websites or you know, PDF downloads or something, you can actually get the maps that you want. I mean, in theory, these desktop GISs now are QGIS. It should be the same as a commercial GIS in terms of how many people need to use it or not. But I mean, I suspect it depends very much on what types of analyses that are being demanded within the different contexts that are being used.
My particular emphasis is on the support environment that needs to be in place to support the open source environment against support environment you're obviously paying for, done with any thousands.
Yes.
So how do you, you know, in times of constrained budgets, how do you, you know, when you can spend 80,000 to buy something off the shelf, how do you manage to convince organisations to put that 80,000 into their running costs?
Yeah.
And actually employ people to do that?
Yeah. I mean, essentially, I have no idea how you convince them of that. I mean, it sounds an extremely logical argument. If you said, well, I've got £8,000 as a training budget to make, you know, person X, you know, QGIS are, oh, by the way, we'll sell our services to, you know, Liverpool or Manchester or something. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think as an academic, those kind of things are probably a little bit out of our remit, maybe. I suspect what you can sort of do is, I mean, what you're always doing is tagging on people by pointing these things out and see what happens, I guess. But, I mean, it doesn't sound like an illogical argument. I know there are problems in the open source community with software licensing, so in a certain context, open source software, because the way in which it, you know, the code can be open, that can be problematic in certain contexts, and that's why you need a commercial version. So our studio, for example, produce a commercial version. Our studio is open source and free. They produce a commercial version as well, so you can license that. I really don't know what the difference is, but you can pay a lot of money for the open source software to give yourself a different license. If you know that's a hurdle. But to be honest, if that's a hurdle in your organisation, you've got to sort that out, because that's wasting money.
But if I could jump in with that one, maybe that's where Alan's comes from, Scottish Central Government, where government can help us out. But if you could take all these 80,000 and put them in a pot, and actually A, it would be a very large saving, and B, actually you could set up a support organisation.
Absolutely. That's how you engineer that in the government world, in the central government, the government world, which is actually an extremely difficult problem. Because it's you can't take a bit of my budget, you can't take it, and it's...
So it's a similar setup, isn't it, to how chess works in academia. So with the chess licenses, we all get discounted licenses. Oh, it costs someone a lot of money, but it doesn't cost any academic a lot of money. And it's probably a discounted rate than what a commercial rate would be anyway. So that sort of match negotiation of licenses, I mean, that's a similar setup that you could do with open source software. It's just, it requires quite a lot of joining up. But also, I think one of the problems that GIS has in general is there's often a myth around what it actually is. I mean, if it is, you know, GIS will solve your problem, oh, okay. You know, but if your problem is just making a map, then that is a slightly different from doing sort of the land space analysis, sort of fit geographic weight regression models or whatever it is. It's being honest about the tasks that actually need to be done.
Mapping tools before people knew what GIS was.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. The census atlas, because you said like something needs to have a problem before you start solving it, but that atlas also looks a bit like an example of just showing what's possible without necessarily...
Oh, I take that criticism. I think the problem, if you've had a problem that size, that was local authorities waste a lot of money making basic correlated maps. Arguably, I might have put someone out of the job. In fact, someone did email me that and say, you've put me out of a job. And I was like, oh, I'm very sorry. It's too late. Upskilled. I mean, basically, the problem as I saw it is that it's a really simple task. It should be automated. It's not difficult to do. I mean, what people use it for in terms of their problem solving, I think that's up to them.
No, sometimes you think, sometimes things can lead to things without knowing exactly whether it's a problem yet. Isn't that also a bit part of creativity, just trying to try things without necessarily knowing whether it's leading to a question, or like leading to an answer to a question that you might not know yet?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose if you map all the variables, you might see something you didn't know. That could lead you to create a new question, you actually investigate a bit further.
Yeah. Interesting your thoughts on this. So, one of the arguments behind open source and open data is this democratization of knowledge, the extent to which you might challenge the sort of dominant production of knowledge, maybe challenge academia actually. But of course, these technologies do require a high level of knowledge, and so I'm struggling when you get a sense of whether there is a shift in the sort of power of production of knowledge, or is it just another elite that's technologically?
I probably towards the latter, to be honest, because I don't buy that. I mean, the potential for you, anyone can go and use open source software, great. Anyone can go and create open source software and critique it. That isn't true, because I can't program a piece of open source software. It's really specialist job. And actually, if you look at the long tail of most open source communities, it's very, very long. So, most open source software, they talk about this principle of many eyes, that it's better than commercial software, because anyone can look at the code and spot an error, and that means it's better because it's more robust and that kind of thing. But that's not always true. On larger projects, it may be true when you have lots of developers working on something. But a lot of open source projects are maybe one or two people. If they make a mistake, that's it. R's the same. I mean, R is it's a single software tool. There's lots of extension packages that can do specific things. So I was looking at some different ways of standardizing data last week, and I got a package I was quite happy with, and I was like, it doesn't work. And then it's basically, I spotted it. I was actually very proud. It was the first bug I spotted someone else's stuff. So politely told them about it, and they're very sort of thankful for that. I mean, that is an example of many others, but that was something which other people who used not spotted that, they'd have some errors in it, but it was only, it's developed by one person and they haven't spotted it. So I'm not totally convinced, but do I think it's worse than a commercial company where it's black box? Probably not, different problem.
Light and light, spare you, reduce links, and all sorts of issues in there. I'm thinking of attitude to risk, or your organisation's attitude to risk, and poor chap out of a job. Hopefully they can upskill, as you say, free them up to do some more interesting things. So I think, shall we call it at that, and progress on to a more informal setting. You might think of a few more questions. So do come along. I should just thank Charlotte and Will in particular who helped set up, and thank you all for coming. So it just remains for me to thank Alex once again for a great talk.